and Grandpa, but not for Dad. Dad had helped set this place up. Maybe he needed one of those black helicopters after all. He slid into his own parking place, number 127. The campus couldn't be all that big and powerful, could it? Not with less than 150 employees. He locked his car and headed in, remarking to himself that this every-morning-to-work thing sucked. But everybody had to start somewhere. He walked in the back entrance like most of the others. There was a reception security desk. The guy there was Ernie Chambers, formerly a sergeant first class in the 1st Infantry Division. His blue uniform blazer had a miniature of the combat infantryman's badge, just in case you didn't notice the shoulders and the hard black eyes. After the first Persian Gulf War, he'd changed jobs from grunt to MP. He'd probably enforced the law and directed traffic pretty well, Jack thought, waving good morning at him. "Hey, Mr. Ryan." "Morning, Ernie. You have a good one, sir." To the ex-soldier, everybody was named Sir. It was 2 hours earlier outside Ciudad Juarez. There, the van pulled into a vehicle service plaza and stopped by a cluster of 4 other vehicles. Behind them were the other minivans who'd followed them all the way to the American border. The men roused from their sleep and stumbled into the chill morning air to stretch. "Here I leave you, senor," the driver said to Mustafa. "You will join the man by the tan Ford Explorer. Vaya con Dios, amigos," he said in the most charming of dismissals. "Go with God." Mustafa walked over and found a tallish man wearing a cowboy-type hat. He didn't appear very clean, and his mustache needed trimming. "Buenos dias. I am Pedro. I will be taking you the rest of the way. There are 4 of you for my vehicle, yes?" Mustafa nodded. "That is correct. There are water bottles in the truck. You may wish to have something to eat. You can buy anything you like from the shop." He waved to the building. Mustafa did. His colleagues did much the same, and after 10 minutes they all boarded the vehicles and headed out. They went west, mostly along Route 2. Immediately, the vehicles broke up, no longer flying formation, as it were. There were 4 of them, all large American-made SUV-type vehicles, all of them coated with a thick coating of dirt and grit, so that they did not appear new. The sun had climbed above the horizon to their rear, casting its shadows onto the khaki-colored ground. Pedro appeared to have spoken his piece back at the plaza. Now he said nothing except an occasional belch, and chain-smoked his cigarettes. He had the radio on to an AM station and hummed along with the Spanish music. The Arabs sat in silence. "Hey, Tony," Jack said in greeting. His workmate was already on his workstation.
"Howdy,"
Wills responded. "Anything hot this morning?" "Not after yesterday, but Langley is talking about putting some coverage on our friend Fa'ad." "Again?" "Will they really do it?"
"Your guess is as good as mine. The station chief in Bahrain is saying that he needs more personnel to make it happen, and the personnel weenies at Langley are probably batting that back and forth right now. My dad liked to say that the government is really run by accountants and lawyers." "He ain't far wrong on that one, buddy. God knows where Ed Kilty fits in that, though. What does your dad think of him?"
"Can't stand the son of a bitch. He won't talk in public about the new administration because he says that's wrong. But if you say something about the guy over dinner, you might end up wearing your wine home." "It's funny. Dad hates politics, and he really tries hard to keep his cool, but that guy is definitely not on the Christmas card list. But he keeps it quiet, won't talk to any reporters about it. Mike Brennan tells me the service doesn't like the new guy either, and they have to like him." "There are penalties for being a professional," Wills agreed. And then Junior lit up his computer and looked at the night traffic between Langley and Fort Meade. It was a lot more impressive in its volume than its content. It seemed that his new friend Uda had...
Our pal Sally had lunch with somebody yesterday, Jack announced.
Who with? Wills asked.
The Brits don't know. Appears Middle Eastern, age about 28, one of those thin, well, narrow beards around the jawline, and mustache, but no ident on the guy. They spoke in Arabic, but nobody got close enough to overhear anything.
Where'd they eat?
Pub on Tower Hill called Hung, Drawn, and Quartered. It's on the edge of the financial district. Uda drank Perrier, his pal had a beer, and they had a British plowman's lunch. They sat in a corner booth, made it hard for whoever was watching to get close and listen in. So they wanted privacy. It doesn't necessarily make them bad guys. Did the Brits tail him?
No. That probably means a single-man tail on Uda?
Probably, Wills agreed.
But it says they got a photo of the new guy.
Not included in the report. It was probably someone from the security service, MI5, doing the surveillance. And probably a junior guy. Uda isn't regarded as very important. Not enough for full coverage. None of those agencies have all the manpower they want. Anything else?
Some money trades that afternoon. Looks pretty routine, Jack said, scrolling through the transactions.
I'm looking for something small and harmless, he reminded himself. But small, harmless things were, for the most part, small and harmless. Uda moved money around every day in large and small amounts. Since he was in the wealth preservation business, he rarely speculated, dealing mostly in real estate transactions. London and Britain in general was a good place to preserve cash. Real estate prices were fairly high but very stable. If you bought something, it might not go up very much, but it sure as hell wasn't going to have the bottom drop out. So, Uda's daddy was letting the kid stretch his legs some, but not letting him run out and play in the traffic.
How much personal liquidity did Uda have?
Since he paid off his whores in cash and expensive handbags, he must have his own cash supply. Maybe modest, but modest by Saudi standards wasn't exactly modest by many others. The kid did drive an Aston Martin, after all, and his dwelling was not in a trailer park, so
how do I differentiate between Solly's trading his family money and trading his own?
You don't. We think he keeps the two accounts close, in the sense both of being covert and near to each other. Your best bet on that is to see how he sets up his quarterly statements to the family. Jack groaned. Oh, great. It'll take me a couple of days to add up all the transactions and then to analyze them. Now you know why you're not a real CPA, Jack.
Wills managed to chuckle.
Jack nearly snarled. But there was only one way to accomplish this task, and it was his job, wasn't it? First he tried to see if his program could shortcut the process.
Nope.
Fourth grade arithmetic with a nose attached. What fun. At least by the time he finished, he'd probably be better at entering numbers into the numeric keypad on the right side of the keyboard. There was something to look forward to.
Why didn't the campus employ some forensic accountants?
They turned off Route 2 onto a dirt road that wound its way north. The road had seen a good deal of use, some of it recent, judging by the tracks. The general area was somewhat mountainous. The real peaks of the Rocky Mountain chain were off to the west, far enough away that he couldn't see them. But the air was thinner here than he was accustomed to, and it would be warm walking. He wondered how far that would be, and how close they were to the U.S. border. He'd heard that the American-Mexican border was guarded, but not well guarded. The Americans could be lethally competent in some areas, but utterly infantile in others. Mustafa and his people hoped to avoid the former and to make use of the latter. About 11 in the morning, he saw a large, boxy truck in the distance and their SUV headed toward it. The truck, he saw as they came closer, was empty, its large red doors open wide. The Ford Explorer came to within 100 meters and stopped. Pedro switched off the engine and got out. "We are here, my friends," he announced. "I hope you are ready to walk." All four of them got out, and as before, they stretched their legs and looked around. A new man walked in their direction as the other three SUVs parked and disgorged their passengers. "Hello, Pedro," the new Mexican greeted the lead driver, evidently an old friend.
"Buenos dias, Ricardo.
Here are the people who want to go to America." "Hello, Pedro," the new Mexican greeted the lead driver, evidently an old friend.
"Buenos dias, Ricardo.
Here are the people who want to go to America."
"Hello."
He shook hands with the first four. "My name is Ricardo, and I am your coyote."
"What?" Mustafa asked.
"It is just a term. I take people across the border for a fee. In your case, of course, I have already been paid."
"How far?"
10 kilometers, a modest walk," he said comfortably. "The country will be mostly like this. If you see a snake, just walk away from it. It will not chase you. But if you get within a meter, it can strike you and kill you. Aside from that, there is nothing to fear. If you see a helicopter, you must fall to the ground and not move. The Americans do not guard their border well, and oddly enough, not as well in daylight as at night. We have also taken some precautions."
"What is that?"
"There were 30 people in that van," he said, pointing to the large truck they'd seen coming in. "They will walk in ahead of and to the west of us. If anyone is caught, it will be them."
"How long will it take?"
3 hours. Less if you are fit.
"Do you have water?"
"We know the desert," Mustafa assured him.
"As you say. Let us be off, then. Follow me, amigo."
And with that, Ricardo started walking north. His clothes were all khaki. He wore a military-style web belt with 3 canteens attached, and he carried military-style binoculars plus an army-style floppy hat. His boots were well-worn. His stride was purposeful and efficient, not overly fast for show, just to cover ground efficiently. They fell in behind him, forming a single file to conceal their numbers from any possible trackers, with Mustafa in the lead, about 5 meters behind their coyote.
There was a pistol range about 300 yards from the plantation house. It was outdoors and had steel targets, a set just like those at the FBI Academy, with head plates, circular and roughly the size of a human head. They made an agreeable clang when hit, and then they fell down, as a human target would do if hit there. Enzo turned out to be better at this. Aldo explained that the Marine Corps didn't emphasize pistol shooting too much, whereas the FBI paid particular attention to it, figuring that anybody could shoot a shoulder weapon accurately. The FBI brother used the two-handed weaver stance, while the Marine tended to stand up straight and shoot one-handed, the way the services taught their people.
"Hey, Aldo, that just makes you a better target," Dominic warned.
"Oh, yeah," Brian rippled off 3 rounds and got 3 satisfying clangs as a result. "Hard to shoot after you take one between the running lights, bro. And what's this one-shot, one-kill crap? Anything worth shooting is worth shooting twice."
"How many did you give that mutt in Alabama?" Brian asked.
3. "I didn't feel like taking any chances," Dominic explained.
"You say so, bro. Hey, let me try that Smith of yours."
Dominic cleared his weapon before handing it over. The magazine went separately. Brian dry-fired it a few times to get used to the feel, then loaded and cycled the action. His first shot clanged a headplate. So did his second. The third one missed, though number 4 did not, 1/3 of a second later. Brian handed the weapon back.
"Feels different in the hand," he explained.
"You get used to it," Dominic promised.
"Thanks, but I like the extra 6 rounds in the magazine."
"Well, that's what you like."
"What's with all this headshot stuff anyway?" Brian wondered. "Okay, shooting sniper rifle, it's the surest one-shot stopper, but not with a pistol."
"When you can do a guy in the head from 15 yards, Pete Alexander answered, "it's just a nice talent to have.
It's the best way of ending an argument I know.
Where did you come from? Dominic asked.
You didn't scan, Agent Caruso.
Remember that even Adolf Hitler had friends. Don't they teach that at Quantico?
Well, yes, Dominic admitted, somewhat crestfallen. When your primary target is down, you scan the area for any friends he might have had. Or you get the hell out of town. Or both.
You mean run away? Brian asked.
Not unless you're on a track. You make your way clear in such a way as to be inconspicuous. That can mean walking into a bookstore and making a purchase, getting a coffee, whatever. You have to make your decision based on circumstances, but keep your objective in mind. Your objective is always to get clear of the immediate area as quickly as circumstances allow. Move too fast, and people will notice. Move too slow, and they might remember seeing you and your subject close together. They will never report the person they didn't notice, so you want to be one of those. What you wear out on the job, the way you act out in the field, the way you walk, the way you think, all of that must be designed to make you invisible, Alexander told them.
In other words, Pete, you're saying that when we kill these people we're training for, Brian observed quietly, you want us to be able to do it and walk away so that we can get away with it.
Would you prefer to be caught? Alexander asked.
No, but the best way to kill somebody is to pop him in the head with a good rifle from a couple of hundred meters away. That works every time.
But what if we want him dead in such a way that nobody knows he was killed? The training officer asked.
How the hell do you manage that? This was Dominic.
Patience, lads. One thing at a time.
There were the remains of some sort of fence. Ricardo just walked through it, using a hole that did not look recent. The fence post had been painted a rich green, but that had mainly rusted off. The fencing material was in even worse shape. Getting through was the least of their problems. The coyote went a further 50 meters or so and selected a large rock, then sat down, lit a smoke, and took a drink from his canteen. It was his first stop. The walk had not been difficult at all, and clearly he'd done this many times. Mustafa and his friends did not know that he'd brought several hundred groups across the border along this very route, and had only been arrested once, and that had not amounted to very much except for stinging his pride. He'd also forfeited his fee, because he was an honorable coyote. Mustafa went over to him.
"Are your friends okay?" Ricardo asked.
"It has not been strenuous," Mustafa replied, "and I have seen no snakes."
"Not too many along here. People usually shoot them, or throw rocks. No one cares much for snakes."
"Are they dangerous? Truly, I mean?"
"Only if you are a fool. And even then you are unlikely to die. You will be ill for a few days, no more than that. But it can make walking rather painful."
"We will wait here for a few minutes. We are ahead of schedule."
"Oh, yes. Welcome to America, amigo."
"That fence is all there is?" Mustafa asked in amazement.
"The Norte Americano is rich, yes, and clever, yes, but he is also lazy. My people would not go there except that there is work the gringo is too lazy to do on his own."
"How many people do you smuggle into America, then?"
"I, you mean? Thousands? Many thousands. For this I am well paid. I have a fine house, and six other coyotes work for me. The gringos worry more about people smuggling drugs across the border, and I avoid doing that. It is not worth the trouble. I let two of my men do that for me. The pay for that is very high, you see."
"What kind of drugs?" Mustafa asked.
"The kind for which I am paid."
He grinned and took another swig from his canteen. Mustafa turned as Abdullah came up.
"I thought this would be a difficult walk," his number two observed.
"Only for city dwellers," Ricardo replied. "This is my country. I was born of the desert."
"As was I," Abdullah observed.
"It is a pleasant day."
Better than sitting in the back of a truck, he didn't have to add.
Ricardo lit up another Newport. He liked menthol cigarettes easier on the throat.
"It does not get hot for another month, perhaps two.
but then it can be truly hot, and the wise man takes a good water supply. People have died out here without water in the August heat, but none of mine. I make sure everyone has water. The Mother Nature, she has no love and no pity, the coyote observed. At the end of his walk, he knew a place where he could get a few cervezas before driving east to El Paso. From there, it was back to his comfortable home in Ascension, too far from the border to be bothered with would-be emigrants, who had a bad habit of stealing things they might need for the crossing. He wondered how much stealing they did on the gringo side of the line, but it was not his problem, was it? He finished his cigarette and stood. 3 more kilometers to go, my friends. Mustafa and his friends fell in and restarted the trudge north. Only 3 kilometers more? At home, they walked farther to a bus stop. Punching numbers into a keypad was about as much fun as running naked in a garden of cactus. Jack was the sort to need intellectual stimulation, and while some men might find that in investigative accounting, he was not one of them.
Bored, eh? Tony Wills asked.
Mightily, Jack confirmed.
Well, that's the reality of gathering and processing intelligence information. Even when it's exciting, it's pretty dull. Well, unless you're on the scent of a particularly elusive fox, then it can be kind of fun. Though it's not like watching your subject out in the field. I've never done that.
Neither did Dad, Jack observed.
Depends on which stories you read. Your pop occasionally found his way to the sharp end. I don't imagine he liked it much. He ever talk about it?
Not ever. Not even once. I don't even think Mom knows much about that. Well, except the submarine thing, but most of what I know about that comes from books and stuff. I asked Dad once, and all he said was, "You believe everything you see in the papers?" Even when that Russian guy, Gerasimov, got on TV, all Dad did was grunt. The word on him at Langley was that he was a king spook, kept all the secrets like he was supposed to. But he mostly worked up in the 7th floor. I never made it that high myself.
Maybe you can tell me something.
Like what?
Gerasimov. Nikolai Borisovich Gerasimov. Was he really the head of KGB? Did my dad really drag his ass out of Moscow?
Wills hesitated for a moment, but there was no avoiding it.
Yeah, he was the KGB chairman, and yes, your dad did arrange his defection.
No shit. How the hell did Dad arrange that one?
That is a very long story, and you are not cleared for it.
Then why did he rat Dad out?
Because he was an unwilling defector. Your father forced him to bug out. He wanted to get even after your dad became president. But you know, Nikolai Borisovich sang. Maybe not like a canary, but he sang anyway. He's in the witness protection program right now. They still bring him in every so often to get him to sing some more. The people you bag, they never give you everything all at once, and so you go back to them periodically. It makes them feel important, enough that they sing some more, usually. He's still not a happy camper. He can't go home. They'd shoot his ass. The Russians have never been real forgiving on state treason. Well, neither are we. So, he lives here with federal protection. Last I heard, he took up golf. His daughter got married to some old money aristocrat asshole in Virginia. She's a real American now, but her dad will die an unhappy man. He wanted to take the Soviet Union over. By which I mean he really wanted that job. But your father screwed that one up for all time. And Nick still carries the grudge.
I'll be damned.
Anything new with Sally? Wills asked, bringing things back to reality.
There's some little stuff, you know, 50,000 here, 80,000 there, pounds, not dollars, into accounts I don't know much about. He goes through anywhere from 2 to 8,000 pounds a week in what he probably considers petty cash.
Where does that cash originate? Wills asked.
Not entirely clear, Tony. I figure he skimmed some off his family account, maybe 2% that he can write off his expenses. Not quite enough to alert his father that he's stealing from Mom and Pop. I wonder how they'd react to that.
Jack speculated.
They wouldn't cut his hand off, but they could do something worse. Cut his money off. You see this guy working for a living?
You mean real work? Jack had himself a brief laugh.
Somehow I don't see that happening. He's been on the gravy train too long to like driving spikes into the ties. I've been to London a lot. Hard to figure how a working stiff survives there.
Wills began humming.
Are you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
Jack flushed.
Look, Tony, yeah, I know I grew up rich, but Dad always made sure I had a summer job. I even worked construction for 2 months.
Made life hard for Mike Brennan and his pals, but Dad wanted me to know what it was like to do real work. I hated it at first, but looking back, it was probably a good thing, I guess.
Mr. Solly here has never done that. I mean, I could survive in a real-world entry-level job if I had to. It'd be a lot harder adjustment for this guy.
Okay, how much unexplained money total?
Maybe 200,000 pounds? 300,000 bucks, call it? But I haven't really pinned it down yet, and it's not all that much money.
How much longer to narrow it down?
At this rate, hell, maybe a week, if I'm lucky. This is like tracking a single car during New York rush hour, you know?
Keep it up.
It isn't supposed to be easy. Or fun.
Aye, aye, sir.
It was something he'd picked up from the Marines at the White House. They'd even said that to him once in a while until his father had noticed and put an immediate end to it.
Jack turned back to his computer. He kept his real notes on a pad of white-lined paper just because it was easier for him that way, then transferred them to a separate computer file every afternoon. As he wrote, he noted that Tony was leaving their little room for a trip upstairs.
"This kid's got the eye," Wills told Rick Bell on the top floor.
"Oh?"
It was a little early for any results from the rookie, regardless who his father was, Bell thought. "I put him on a young Saudi living in London name of Uda bin Sali, money changer for his family's interests. The Brits have a loose tail on him because he called somebody they found interesting once.
And?
And Junior has found a couple of 100,000 pounds that can't be accounted for.
How solid is that?" Bell asked.
"We'll have to put a regular on it, but you know, this kid's got the right sort of nose.
Dave Cunningham, maybe?
A forensic accountant, he'd joined the campus out of the Department of Justice, Organized Crime Division. Pushing 60, Dave had a legendary nose for numbers. The trading department at the campus mainly used him for conventional duties. He could have done very well on Wall Street, but he just loved bagging bad guys for a living. At the campus, he could pursue that avocation well past government retirement rules."
"Dave'd be my pick," Tony agreed.
"Okay, let's cross-load Jack's computer files to Dave and see what he turns over.
Works for me, Rick.
You see the take report from NSA yesterday?"
"Yeah, got my attention,"
Bell answered, looking up. 3 days before, message traffic from sources that the government intelligence services found interesting had dropped by 17%, and two particularly interesting sources had almost completely stopped. When radio traffic in a military unit did that, it often meant a stand down prior to real operations. The sort of thing that made signals intelligence people nervous. The majority of the time it meant nothing at all, just random chance in operation, but it had developed into something real often enough that the signal spooks frequently went into a tizzy about it.
"Any ideas?" Wills asked.
Bell shook his head. "I stopped being superstitious about 10 years ago."
Clearly, Tony Wills had not.
"Rick, we're due. We've been due for a long time."
"I know what you're saying, but we can't run this place on that sort of stuff."
"Rick, this is like sitting at a ball game. Dugout seats, maybe, but you still can't go on the field when you want."
"To do what? Kill the umpire?"
Bell asked.
"No.
Just the guy planning to throw a beanball."
"Patience, Tony, patience.
Son of a bitch of a virtue to acquire, isn't it?"
Wills had never quite learned it, despite all his experience.
"Think you have it bad. What about Jerry?" Yeah, Rick, I know. He stood. Later, man. They'd seen not another human being, not a car, not a helicopter. Clearly there was nothing of value out here. No oil, no gold, not even copper. Nothing worth guarding or protecting. The walk had just been enough to be healthy. Some scrubby bushes, even some stunted trees. A few tire tracks, but none of them recent. This part of America might as well have been Saudi Arabia's empty quarter, the Rub al-Khali, where even a hardy desert camel would have found it grim going. But clearly the walk was over. As they crested a small rise, they saw five more vehicles sitting all alone, with men standing by them, talking among themselves. Ah, Ricardo said, they are early too. Excellent. He could dump these morose foreigners and get on with his business. He stopped and let his clients catch up. This is our destination? Mustafa asked, with hope in his voice. It had been an easy walk, far easier than he'd expected. My friends there will take you to Las Cruces. There you can make your travel plans for the future. And you? Mustafa asked.
I go home to my family, Ricardo answered. Wasn't that simple enough? Maybe this guy didn't have a family.
The remaining walk took only 10 minutes. Ricardo got in the lead SUV after shaking hands with his party. They were friendly enough, albeit in a guarded fashion. It could have been harder to get them here, but illegal immigrant traffic was far thicker in Arizona and California, and that was where the U.S. Border Patrol had most of its personnel. The gringos tended to grease the squeaky wheel, like everyone else in the world, perhaps, but still it was not terribly far-sighted of them. Sooner or later they'd realize that there was cross-border traffic here, too, just not the dramatic sort. Then he might have to find a new way to make a living. He'd done well the past 7 years, however, enough to set up a little business and raise his children into a more legitimate line of work. He watched his party board their transport and motor off. He also headed in the general direction of Las Cruces, then turned south on I-10 toward El Paso. He'd long since stopped wondering what his clients planned to do in America. Probably not tending gardens or doing construction work, he judged, but he'd been paid $10,000 in American cash. So, they were important to someone, but not to him. Chapter 10 Destinations. For Mustafa and his friends, the ride to Las Cruces was a surprisingly welcome break, and though they didn't show it, there was obvious excitement now. They were in America. Here were the people they proposed to kill. The mission was now somehow closer to fulfillment, not by a mere handful of kilometers, but by a magical, invisible line. They were in the home of the great Satan. Here were the people who had rained death upon their homeland and upon the faithful throughout the Muslim world, the people who so fawningly supported Israel. At Deming, they turned east for Las Cruces, 62 miles, 100 kilometers, to their next intermediate stop along I-10. There were billboards advertising road hotels and places to eat, tourist attractions of types routine and inconceivable, and more rolling land and horizons which seemed far even as the car ate up the distances at a steady 70 miles per hour. Their driver, as before, looked Mexican and said nothing. Probably another mercenary. Nobody said anything. The driver because he didn't care, his passengers because their English was accented and the driver might take note of it. This way he'd only remember that he picked up some people on a dirt road in southern New Mexico and driven them someplace else. It was probably harder for the others in his party, Mustafa thought. They had to trust him to know what he was doing. He was the mission commander, the leader of a warrior band about to divide into four parts that would never reunite. The mission had been painstakingly planned. The only future communications would be via computer, and few enough of those. They'd function independently, but to a simple timetable and toward a single strategic objective. This plan would shake America as no other plan had ever done, Mustafa told himself, looking into a station wagon as it passed them. Two parents, and what appeared to be two little ones, a boy about 4 and a smaller one, perhaps 1.5 years. Infidels, all of them. Targets. His operational plan was all written down, of course, in 14-point Geneva type on sheets of plain white paper. 4 copies, 1 for each team leader. The other data was in files on the personal computers that all of the men had in their small carry bags, along with spare shirts and clean underwear and little else. They would not need much, and the plan was to leave very little behind in order to further befuddle the Americans. It was enough to generate a thin smile at the passing countryside. Mustafa lit up a cigarette. He only had 3 left, and took a deep breath of tobacco smoke, and the air conditioning blew cold air on him. Behind them, the sun was declining in the sky. They'd make their next and last stop in the darkness, which he considered was good tactical planning. He knew it was only an accident, but if so, it meant that Allah himself was smiling on their plan, as he ought to do, of course. They were all doing his work. Another dull day's work done, Jack told himself on the way to his car. One bad thing about the campus was that he couldn't discuss it with anybody. Nobody was cleared for this stuff, though it was not yet evident why. He could surely kick this around with his dad. The president was, by definition, cleared for anything, and ex-presidents had the same access to information, if not by law, then by the rules of practicality. But no, he couldn't do that. Dad would not be pleased by his new job. Dad could make a phone call and screw all of that up. And Jack had had enough of a taste to keep himself hungry for a few months at least. Even so, the ability to kick a few things around with somebody who knew what was going on would have been a blessing of sorts. Just someone to say, yes, it really is important, and yes, you really are contributing to truth, justice, and the American way. Could he really make a difference? The world worked the way it worked, and he couldn't change it much. Even his father, for all the power that had come to him, had been unable to do that. How much less could he, a junior prince of sorts, be able to accomplish? But if the broken parts of the world were ever to be fixed, it would have to be at the hands of someone who didn't care if it were impossible or not. Probably someone too young and dumb to know that impossible things were impossible. But neither his mother nor his father believed in that word, and that's the way they had raised him. Sally was graduating medical school soon, and she was going on to oncology, the one thing their mother had regretted not doing with her own medical career. And she told everyone who asked that she was going to be there when the cancer dragon was finally slain once and for all. So, believing in impossibility was not part of the Ryan Creed. He just didn't know how yet, but the world was full of things to learn, wasn't it? And he was smart and well-educated. And having a sizable trust fund meant that he could go forward without fear of starving if he offended the wrong person. That was the most important freedom his father had bequeathed him. And John Patrick Ryan, Jr. was smart enough to know just how important it was, if not to grasp the responsibility that such freedom carried with it. Instead of cooking their own dinner, they decided to go to a local steakhouse that night. It was full of college kids from the University of Virginia. You could tell. They all looked bright, but not as bright as they thought they were. And they were all a little too loud, a little too confident in themselves. That was one of the advantages of being children, much as they would have detested that appellation. Kids whose needs were still looked after by loving parents, albeit at a comfortable distance. To the two Caruso boys, it was a humorous look at what they'd themselves been only a few short years ago, before harsh training and experience in the real world had turned them into something else. Exactly what, they were not yet sure. What had seemed so simple in school had become infinitely complex after leaving the academic womb. The world was not digital after all. It was an analog reality. Always untidy, always with loose ends that could never be tied up neatly like shoelaces. And so it was possible to trip and fall with every incautious step. And caution only came with experience, with a few trip and falls that brought pain, only the worst of which taught remembered lessons. Those lessons had come early to the brothers. Not as early as they'd come to other generations, but still soon enough for them to realize the consequences of errors in a world that had never learned to forgive.
Not a bad place, Brian judged, halfway through his filet mignon.
Hard to mess up a decent piece of beef, no matter how dumb the cook is. This place obviously had a cook, not a chef, but the steak fries were pretty good for nearly raw carbohydrates, and the broccoli was fresh out of the freezer bag, Dominic thought.
I really ought to eat better than this, the Marine Major observed.
Enjoy it while you can. We're not 30 yet, are we? That was good for a laugh.
Used to seem like an awfully big number, didn't it?
Where old age starts? Oh, yeah. Well, you're pretty young for a major, right?
Aldo shrugged. I suppose. My boss liked me, and I had some good people working for me. I never did take a liking to MREs, though. They keep you going, but that's about all I can say for them. My gunny loved the things. Said they were better than what he'd grown up in the Corps with.
In the Bureau, you tend to live on Dunkin' Donuts. And, well, they make about the best industrial coffee in America. It's hard to keep your belt loose on that kind of diet.
You're in decent shape for a desk-bound warrior, Enzo, Brian observed rather generously.
At the end of the morning run, his brother occasionally looked as though he was about to drop. But a 3-mile run was just like morning coffee for a Marine, something to open the eyes.
I still wish I knew exactly what we're training for, Aldo said after another bite.
Bro, we're training to kill people. That's all we need to know. Sneak up without being seen, and then get the hell away without being noticed.
With pistols? Brian responded dubiously. Kinda noisy, and not as sure as a rifle.
I had a sniper with my team in Afghanistan. He did some bad guys a damn near a mile. Used a Barrett 50 rifle, big mother. Like an old BAR on steroids. Shoots the 50 round from the Ma Deuce machine gun. Accurate as hell, and it makes for a definitive hit, you know? Kinda hard to walk away with a half-inch hole in you.
Especially since his sniper, Corporal Alan Roberts, a black kid from Detroit, had preferred headshots, and the 50 really did the job on heads.
Well, maybe suppressed ones. You can silence a handgun fairly well.
I've seen those. We trained with them at recon school, but they're awful bulky for carrying under a business suit, and you still have to take them out and stand still and aim them at the target's head. Unless they send us to James Bond school to get courses in magic, we're not going to be killing many people with handguns, Enzo.
Well, maybe we'll be using something else.
So you don't know either.
Hey, man, my checks still come from the Bureau. All I know is that Gus Werner sent me here, and that makes it most of the way kosher, I think, he concluded.
You mentioned him before. Who is he, exactly?
Assistant Director, head of the new Counterterrorism Division. You don't fuck with Gus. He was head of the hostage rescue team, got all his other tickets punched too. Smart guy and tough as hell. I don't think he faints at the sight of blood. But he's also got a real head on his shoulders. Terrorism is the new thing at the Bureau, and Dan Murray didn't pick him for the job just because he can shoot a gun. He and Murray are tight. They go back 20-plus years. Murray ain't no dummy either. Anyway, if he sent me here, it's got to be okay with somebody, so I'll play along until they tell me to break the law.
Me too, but I'm still a little nervous.
Las Cruces had a regional airport for short hauls and puddle jumpers. Along with that came rent-a-car outlets. They pulled in, and it was time for Mustafa to get nervous. He and one of his colleagues would hire cars here. Two more would make use of a similar business in the town itself.
"It is all prepared for you," the driver told them. He handed over two sheets of paper. "Here are the reservation numbers. You'll be driving Ford Crown Victoria four-door sedans. We could not get you station wagons as requested without going to El Paso, and that was not desirable. Use your Visa card in there. Your name is Tomas Salazar. Your friend is Hector Santos. Show them the reservation numbers, and just do what they tell you to do. It is very easy."
Neither man struck the driver as overly Latin in appearance, but the people of this rental office were both ignorant paddies who spoke little Spanish beyond taco and cerveza. Mustafa got out of the car and walked in, waving for his friend to follow. Immediately he knew it would be easy. Whoever owned this business, he hadn't troubled himself with recruiting intelligent people. The boy running the desk was hunched over it, reading a comic book with attention that looked a little too rapt.
"Hello," Mustafa said, with false confidence. "I have reservation."
He wrote the number down on a pad and handed it to him.
"Okay."
The attendant didn't show his annoyance at being diverted from the newest Batman adventure. He knew how to work the office computer. Sure enough, the computer spat out a rental form already filled out in most details. Mustafa handed over his international driver's license, which the employee Xeroxed, and then he stapled the photocopy to his copy of the rental form. He was delighted that Mr. Salazar took all of the insurance options. He got extra money for encouraging people to do that.
"Okay, your car is the white Ford in slot number 4. Just go out that door and turn right. The keys are in the ignition, sir."
"Thank you," Mustafa said in accented English. Was it really this easy? Evidently it was. He'd just got the seat in his Ford adjusted when Saeed showed up at slot number 5 for a light green twin to his sedan. Both had maps of the state of New Mexico, but they didn't need them, really. Both men started their cars and eased out of their parking slots and headed off to the street, where the SUVs were waiting. It was simple enough to follow them. The town of Las Cruces had traffic, but not all that much at the dinner hour. There was another rental car agency just 8 blocks north on what appeared to be the main street of Las Cruces. This one was called Hertz, which struck Mustafa as vaguely Jewish in character. His two comrades walked in and 10 minutes later walked back out and got in their leased cars. Again, they were Fords of the same make as his and Saeed's. With that done, perhaps the most hazardous mission they had to accomplish, it was time to follow the SUVs north for a few kilometers, about 20 as it turned out, then off this road onto another dirt one. There seemed to be a lot of those here. Just like home, in fact. Another kilometer or so, and there was a house standing alone, with only a truck parked nearby to suggest residency. There, all the vehicles parked, and the occupants got out for what would be, Mustafa realized, their last proper meeting.
"We have your weapons here," Juan told them. He pointed to Mustafa. "Come with me, please."
The inside of this ordinary-looking wood-frame structure appeared to be a virtual arsenal. A total of 16 cardboard boxes held 16 MAC-10 submachine guns. Not an elegant firearm, the MAC is made of machined steel stampings, with a generally poor finish on the metal. With each weapon were 12 magazines, apparently all loaded and taped together end-to-end with black electrician's tape.
"The weapons are virgins. They have not been fired," Juan told them. "We also have suppressors for each of them. They are not efficient silencers, but they improve balance and accuracy. This gun is not as easily handled as the Uzi, but those are also more difficult to obtain here. For this weapon, its effective range is about 10 meters. It is easily loaded and unloaded. It fires from an open bolt, of course, and the rate of fire is quite high.
It would, in fact, empty a 30-round magazine in less than 3 seconds.
which was a little too fast for sensible use. But these people didn't seem overly particular to Juan. They weren't. Each of the 16 Arabs lifted a weapon and hefted it, as though to say hello to a new friend. Then one lifted a magazine pair.
Stop! Alto!
Juan snapped at once. You will not load these weapons inside. If you wish to test fire them, we have targets outside.
Will this not be too noisy? Mustafa asked.
The nearest house is 4 kilometers away, Juan answered dismissively. The bullets could not travel that far, and he assumed the noise could not either. In this he was mistaken. But his guests assumed he knew everything about the area, and they were always willing to shoot guns off, especially the rock and roll kind. 20 meters from the house was a sand berm with some crates and cardboard boxes scattered about. One by one, they inserted the magazines into their SMGs and pulled back the bolts. There was no official command to fire. Instead, they took their lead from Mustafa, who grasped the strap dangling from the muzzle and pulled his trigger back. The immediate results were agreeable. The MAC-10 made the appropriate noise, jumping up and right as all such weapons did. But since this was his first time, and this was just range shooting, he managed to walk his rounds into a cardboard box about 6 meters to his left front. In seemingly no time at all, the bolt slammed shut on an empty chamber, having fired and ejected 30 Remington 9mm pistol cartridges. He thought of extracting the magazine and reversing it to enjoy another 2 or 3 seconds of blazing bliss, but he managed to control himself. There would be another time for that, in the not-too-distant future.
The silencers? He asked Juan.
Inside. They screw on the muzzle, and it's better to screw them on. Easier to control how they spray their bullets, you see. Juan spoke with some authority. He'd used the MAC-10 to eliminate business competitors and other unpleasant people in Dallas and Santa Fe over the years. Despite that, he looked on his guests with a certain unease. They grinned too much. They were not as he was, Juan Sandoval told himself, and the sooner they went on their way, the better. It would not be so for the people at their destinations, but that was not his concern. His orders came from on high. Very on high, his immediate superior had made clear to him the week before, and the money had been commensurate. Juan had no particular complaint, but as a good reader of people, he had a red light flashing behind his eyes. Mustafa followed him back in and picked up the suppressor. It was perhaps 10 centimeters in diameter and 0.5 meter or so long. As promised, it screwed onto the thread on the gun's muzzle, and on the whole, it did improve the weapon's balance. He hefted it briefly and decided that he'd prefer to use it this way. Better to reduce muzzle climb and make for more accurate shooting. The reduction in noise had little bearing on his mission, but accuracy did. But the suppressor made an easily concealed weapon unacceptably bulky. So he unscrewed it for now and replaced the silencer in its carry bag. Then he went outside to gather his people. Juan followed him back out.
"Some things you need to know," he told the team leaders. Juan went on in a slow, measured voice. "The American police are efficient, but they are not all-powerful. If, during your driving, one pulls you over, all you need to do is to speak politely. If he asks you to get out of the car, then get out, as he says. He is allowed by American laws to see if you have a weapon on your person, to search you with his hands. But if he asks you to search your car, simply say no. I do not wish you to do that. And by their laws, he may not search your car. I will say this again. If an American policeman asks to search your car, you need only say no, and then he may not do it. Then drive away. When you drive, do not go faster than the number on the highway signs. If you do that, you will probably not be disturbed in any way. If you go faster than the speed limit,
all you do is give the police a reason to pull you over? So, do not do that. Exercise patience at all times. Do you have any questions? What if a policeman is too aggressive? Can we... Juan knew that question was coming. Heal one. Yes, it is possible to do so, but then you will have many more police chasing you. When a police officer pulls you over, the very first thing he will do is radio his location and the license number of your car and a description to his headquarters. So even if you kill him, his comrades will look for you in a matter of minutes and in large numbers. It is not worth the satisfaction of killing the policeman. You will only invite more trouble on yourselves. American police forces have many cars and even aircraft. Once they start looking for you, they will find you. So, your only defense against that is to escape notice. Do not speed. Do not break their traffic laws. Do that and you will be safe. Violate those laws and you will be caught, guns or not. Do you understand this?
We understand, Mustafa assured him. Thank you for your assistance.
We have maps for all of you. They are good maps from the American Automobile Association. You all have cover stories, yes? Juan asked, hoping to get this over as quickly as he could.
Mustafa looked at his friends for additional inquiries, but they were too eager to get on with their business to be sidetracked now. Satisfied, he turned to Juan. Thank you for your help, my friend.
Friend be damned, Juan thought.
But he took the man's hand and walked them around to the front of the building. Bags were quickly transferred from the SUVs to the sedans, and then he watched them pull off, heading back to State Route 185. It was only a few miles to Radium Springs and the entrance onto I-25 North. The foreigners gathered one last time to shake hands and even share a few kisses, Juan was surprised to see. Then they split up into four teams of four men each and entered their rental cars. Mustafa settled in his car. He set his cigarette packs on the seat next to him, made sure that the mirrors were properly aligned for his eyes, and buckled his seatbelt. He'd been told that not buckling was as likely as speeding to get himself pulled over. Above all things, he didn't want to be pulled over by a policeman. Despite the briefing instructions he'd received from Juan, it was a risk he felt no desire to run. Passing by, a cop might not recognize them for what they were, but face to face was something else again, and he had no illusions about how Americans thought of Arabs. For that reason, all copies of the Holy Quran were tucked away in the trunk. It would be a long time. Abdullah would spell him at the wheel, but the first stint would be his. North on I-25 to Albuquerque, then east on I-40 almost all the way to their target. Over 3,000 kilometers. He'd have to start thinking in miles now, Mustafa told himself. 1.6 kilometers to a mile. He'd have to multiply every number by that constant, or just disregard metric altogether as far as his car was concerned. Whatever, he drove north on Route 185 until he saw the leaf-green sign and the arrow for I-25 North. He settled back in his seat, checked traffic as he merged, and increased speed to 65 miles per hour, setting the Ford's cruise control right on that number. After that, it was just a matter of steering, and watching all of the anonymous traffic which, like him and his friends, was headed north to Albuquerque. Jack didn't know why it was hard to go to sleep. It was past 11 in the evening. He'd seen his nightly take of TV and had his two or three. Tonight it had been three drinks. He should have been sleepy. He was sleepy, as a matter of fact, but sleep wasn't coming, and he didn't know why. Just close your eyes and think happy thoughts, his mom had told him as a little boy. But thinking happy thoughts was the hard part now that he wasn't a kid anymore. He'd entered into a new world that had few enough of those in it.
His job was to examine the known and suspected facts concerning people he'd probably never meet, try to decide if they wanted to kill other people he'd never meet, then pass